So good afternoon, everyone. A very good afternoon, Alex. For those of you who were not here this morning, my name is Peter Koch. I'll guide you through the second session of the DNS Working Group today. I am, as Jim already mentioned, one of the three co-chairs of the DNS Working Group, with the other ones probably being stuck in the working group chairs discussion still. So this is the second part of the agenda. We will first have a 10-minute overview on the RIPE NCC update to be given to us by Anand. Shane Kerr will have a presentation about his analysis of lame delegations, actually for the reverse space, I guess, in the RIPE region, as a follow-up to the action item that I mentioned this morning. Then we will have two presentations, one given by Dwayne Vessels about the OARC root zone augmentation impact analysis. Lyman Chapin will talk about the root zone scaling survey findings that were already mentioned in the plenary. And after that, we will have an open discussion on all these root scaling issues. So we will probably take questions for K and L only for clarification and have the discussion afterwards. And if there's time left, we're going to have any other business. So that said, I'd like to ask Anand to come up to the stage and do the presentation. We have a pretty packed agenda and try to get through here, which is, oops, no, that's the first one. I need to go back. Do you find it?
I can't see it there. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Anand Buthadev. I'll be providing the RIPE NCC DNS update. For those of you who don't know us, just a quick introduction. We're a small team at the RIPE NCC. We consist of three people. Sjoerd Oosthuijzen, who is actually here. Wolfgang Nagele, he's currently on holiday, so he's not here. And myself, I manage the DNS services department. So we have a number of services that we provide for to the RIPE NCC region as well as the general internet. We operate one of the 13 root servers, and that's KRoot. We also provide reverse DNS services for all the IPv4 and IPv6 address space that we allocate. We do provide some secondary DNS services for some of the ccTLDs that don't have the financial or technical resources to run their own secondary DNS. We are also responsible for the operations of the enum zone. We also operate an AS112 node, more details of this coming up. We've also been signing all our forward and reverse zones since 2005. And we're also responsible for the management of the RIPE NCC internal DNS services, such as the RIPE.NET zone. Some updates about KRoot. This year, we have started cooperating with Afrinic to expand KRoot and deploy new instances in their region. We have already deployed one region, and that's in one instance, and that's in Dar es Salaam. And we've got plans to add new instances in Maputo, Mozambique, and Kampala, Uganda, and a few others in the pipeline. Other updates: our instance in Frankfurt used to be what we called a local instance, and we have now upgraded it to the status of global, meaning that the prefix is available throughout the internet. We've also been busy with software updates. We've done all kinds of OS updates and security updates, and we've recently moved to NSD version 3. So we are going to continue our plans for expansion. We are talking to LACNIC about possible cooperation with them to install some new instances in the LACNIC region. We're also busy doing some preparations for the arrival of assigned root zone and assigned ARPA zone. As you've heard from Matt Larson and Joe, this root zone is going to be signed quite soon. ARPA is also going to be signed by the 1st of December, so we've got lots of preparations to do. We're also busy with hardware replacements, old servers that need to be replaced. And we plan to announce the IPv6 prefix of KRoot from even more instances. A quick update about the lameness project. At the last RIPE meeting, it was pointed out to us that we were sending email alerts to some email addresses which weren't quite responsible for some of these zones. We actually found a bug in our software, and we fixed it. What our software now does is to look up the zone contact and the technical contact and send emails to them. And if not, it falls back to the MNT by attribute. We are continuing to run monthly checks, and we publish these results to the RIPE NCC website. And what we've done is we've lowered the alert frequency. So instead of sending monthly emails, we send them now every 3 months. We, at the moment, we are performing checks against over 1 million pairs, zone and name server pairs, and we find that about 5.5% of these are lame. There's another issue. We often get tickets from confused users, and the reason for this confusion is that there are over 15,000 domain objects in the RIPE database for the /24 boundary, which actually have /16 parents. And as you might know, DNS works in such a way that we cannot do delegation for the child if the parent is already delegated. So our provisioning system actually ignores all these, and we get tickets from confused users. I've created a /24. Why isn't my delegation visible? As an example, there's this 192.94.inadder.arpa, and it's delegated to some servers. There exists a child, and The provisioning system ignores them, causes confusion for the users. There's an action item with the database working group to actually disallow this and remove these objects. This was an action item on the RIPE NCC. RIPE NCC's trust anchors are in the DLV, ISC DLV, and they're still available in the ISC DLV. ISC believes that this helps the deployment of DNSSEC, and so they will continue to publish these in the DLV. We are satisfied that ISC makes every effort to check that they've imported the trust anchors correctly, but our recommendation is for users to continue to fetch trust anchors from the RIPE NCC website. DNSSEC growth, it's been growing, but very slowly. Some numbers here from RIPE 54 to RIPE 59. We now have 181 signed zones in the reverse tree. But there's some lameness. Out of the 181 zones, 38 have secure delegations, but there are no DNS keys in the zone. And two of them we found have secure delegations, but this doesn't match the DNS keys in the zone. The result of this is that validating resolvers cannot resolve these reverse zones. And what we intend to do is incorporate this kind of lameness check into our lameness project and periodically alert users that their DS records may have expired. We have plans to improve our DNSSEC infrastructure. We have a new signer, which we are going to be deploying quite soon. We also want to improve the co-location, make it more secure, and review all our operating procedures. When we do the transition from the old signer to the new signer, we will sign our zones using both of them. This will result in no changes to our policies and procedures, and users will not notice anything. We also want to improve our website, change the documentation, make it simpler for users to fetch our trust anchors. The enum zone operations are stable. There's been one new delegation since the last RIPE meeting, and that's Jordan. Three of the zones are now signed, and the Netherlands is soon going to introduce a secure delegation into the enum zone. We also operate an AS112 node. This essentially mops up all the reverse DNS queries for RFC 1918 space. We've installed new hardware and a new OS, and this node is operated at M6 and hits about 2,000 queries per second. Thank you for listening, and if you have any questions, please let me know.
A minute or two for some questions. Dennis.
Tall, but. Dennis Walker, RIPE NCC. You asked the database to remove slash 24s where there is an existing slash 16 and not allow the creation. What happens if you create a slash 16 as an existing slash 24? Should we delete that one because it now becomes ineffective?
I think that the creation of the slash 16 domain object should be rejected because that would also break DNS. So it would work both ways. You wouldn't allow creation of the parent if the child exists, or allow creation of the child if the parent exists.
But there are
Dennis, I've got to be rude. That's why I'm here. I suggest we take this discussion offline, and it should happen within the NCC in the first place. Yeah. With community input, of course, but this seems to touch upon a very seldom operational thing in transition. But yeah. Thanks for bringing this up, and it would be great to post it to the mailing list.
Hey, Ed Lewis, I have two questions about the DLV interface. One, do you contact them when you do a key change, and do you confirm that they've made the change? That's one question.
We do not contact ISC when we roll our keys. We do not encourage ISC in any way to import our trust anchors into the DLV. Our position is that users should always import keys from our website.
Okay. The second question is, do you know of any other trust anchor repositories, things of the DLV type, that are out there that you are either aware of, concerned, or might want to make sure they're up to date too?
I'm aware of the SEC Spider, which also fetches trust anchors and imports them. And I know that they have our trust anchors, but SEC Spider is purely experimental, and We don't see any reason to check if they have correctly imported, and usage of SexSpider, if it causes any problems, is a user's caveat.
Hi, just one quick question, I hope. Otherwise, I'll eat my own presentation time. ARPA is going to be signed, right? Is InAdder ARPA delegated from ARPA, or how does that work?
Yes, InAdder is delegated from ARPA.
And who runs InAdder.ARPA?
InAdder ARPA is delegated to a set of name servers around the internet, which includes some of the regional registries, such as the RIPE NCC.
I guess my question is, if ARPA is signed and the RIPE NCCs /8 are signed, but InAdder.ARPA isn't signed, then we actually haven't gained anything in the reverse space, at least.
Is someone from ICANN / yeah, Joe?
Hello. I can't speak about any current plans to sign InAdder.ARPA right now, but just as a point of information, the InAdder.ARPA is actually served by a subset of the root servers right now. IP6.ARPA is served by some RIR servers.
Thank you for the correction.
It's probably not so much by which server it's served, but who is the maintainer of that zone in practice.
I think today the top-level zone is currently created by Aaron.
Okay, thanks. You touched, I guess, two or three action items that we might want to close right now. The one is that about the lameness issue, and I'd like to postpone that discussion until after Shane's presentation. The second one that we just saw, you had internal discussion with Dennis about. Any opposition to keeping this open and running so that Anand can take care of this? One, two, gone. Okay, so this is kept alive. And the last one is to come up with a position or recommendation regarding the RIPE NCC maintained zones key material in ISE's DLV. And I think we've seen a response here. You've tried to pursue this further with, say, little success. So is there anything the working group would like to add to this, or do you feel we can close this action item, which would be my proposal? Everybody comfortable with closing it? Okay, thank you. Done.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Anand. And next on the agenda is Shane Kerr with his findings on a lame delegation survey, and as I said, roughly related to a presentation of last time and a discussion we had to cut off.
Right. So I'm Shane Kerr. I work at ISC, and as Peter said, this came out of a discussion from lameness from last time, last RIPE meeting. Right. So the RIPE NCC implemented a system which checks for lame DNS servers in the part of the verse 2 they maintain. This came out of an action that this working group actually requested this from a while ago. And I thought, well, it seemed like a lot of effort, and it seemed like annoyance to people. So I thought maybe we should check to see if there's a problem before we solve it. It's a bit sad because we've actually already NCC spent a lot of time actually implementing the solution. But I said, well, okay. And then the RIPE NCC said, well, okay, we agree. Why don't you go ahead and do that then? So I said, all right. Right. So I didn't do this in a vacuum. The RIPE NCC DNS department, Anand and his people, provided data and explained how the system worked, gave me access to the database and things like that. I actually used OARC, which is OARC DNS, which is a research group for doing just this kind of analysis of DNS data. It lets me do the analysis on a server without people having to worry if I'm going to download it onto my laptop and then sell it on eBay or something. So thank you to both RIPE NCC and the OARC for letting this happen. Right, so what did I actually do? The RIPE NCC runs these lameness checks, and it's pretty straightforward. You do a, because the RIPE NCC has the set of NS records for each delegation. So they try to convert each of those into either an A or a quad A. And then they do an SOA lookup for the domain at each of those addresses. So these are the kind of two places where things can go wrong. And it's actually a lot more sophisticated than that. They do it with over the period of time and a number of retries and good things like this. Plus they have the additional work of having to figure out contacts and stuff. I don't care about any of that. This is for this activity, this is what's important. So what the RIPE-NCC did was they did some packet captures at one of their primaries, nsprio.ripe.net, and it was for a period of 1 hour dumps over, I think it was 1 hour, yeah, 1 hour over a day or so at different times so we could see if there was any trend throughout the day. So the actual methodology is we have what people are querying and the answers we're giving, and we have the known broken servers because we've done these checks. So what we want to do is see, are people querying for broken servers, or are they querying for servers that are good? So the question is, does lameness matter, right? And it could be that you have a million lame servers, but you only get one query a day, so why do you care? Or it could be that you have one lame server, but it gets half your queries. So we're trying to figure out how this works. Right, so how did we do this? How did I do this? I parsed each reply to find out what the NSR set was. These are the list of named servers that it was sending back in reply. There's a very small mismatch because the lameness checks run over a period of weeks and the captures are at a specific time, but that ended up being, as you can see, 3 NS in 1 hour of packet capture. So there is a bit of churn, but it's not a huge amount of churn to affect the results. So I'm going to pretend like that's not important. So what do we do? If there's no NS in the answer we give back, then we're done, we're fine, because there's no chance of lameness affecting this query if there's no NS in there. So NX domains, if there's no answer for that, obviously you get that. And there's SOA queries, which you get from your secondaries and things like that, and a whole bunch of errors. Not as many as I thought, but all of this stuff is categorized as unaffected by lameness. And then if there is an NS return, we check to see if lameness affects it. So there's more than one way for a server to be lame. Given that we have this kind of two-step process, we can have an error in both steps. So the first is that we may not resolve to an A record. In the example that we have up here, I just gave some typos, which is probably a common error, I would assume. I assume that there's not sophisticated checking when records are added for this kind of thing, so this is the kind of thing we'll see. There's a million other reasons and a record may not resolve. You know, it could be just any of the servers are down. It could be all kinds of things. I did not go into detailed analysis of why NS records didn't resolve to A or quad A records. I just categorized that as one type of error. And then if you did get an address, you may not be able to query at that server. That's kind of the second large category of errors. And you can see here, this person probably mistyped their first octet of their IP address. So. Right, so a little diagram, which I don't usually do. So basically, we start off, we get a query. We look at the answer that we get on the upper right there. It has a set of 3 NSs in it. And then we try to look at how we turn those name servers into IP addresses. And you see the bottom one there, we don't actually have any IP addresses that resolve, so that we put XXX there. And then finally, we look at the actual servers, and we see here that of the 3 example ones that I made up, 2 of them are responding okay, and one of them doesn't respond properly. So this is kind of the process of looking at this stuff. Right, so given these two large classes of error, what is the impact on the user if there is lameness? If you have a bad NS, it could cause all kinds of things. For example, if someone mistyped their domain name, like in one of the examples I gave, then you're going to get an NX domain right away, and your server's going to reply very quickly. You won't get an answer, but especially in the case of reverse DNS, a fast negative response is probably okay. Unfortunately, you also could get timeouts if servers are badly maintained or things like that, or your some name server implementations DJB DNS. We'll just drop a query they don't understand, which causes unpleasant behavior on the resolvers because they have to wait for a timeout. Now, unfortunately, I don't really know based on the data that we have what exactly the impact on the user is going to be. So it could be something like this. And so the reason that I bring this up is because, in my mind, the worst thing that we can do is make the user wait 30 seconds for an answer. That's a real negative impact of lame DNS. Right, so we saw that we can break down our NS records. And because of the way DNS works, you have, in theory, a good resolver will pick at random out of the name servers that it gets back as an answer. So basically, you have an equally distributed chance of hitting a bad name server. So if you have two NS and only one is bad, you're going to have a 50-50 chance of getting that. If there's three and one bad, you have a 1 in 3 chance. It gets a little more complicated if you have three name servers and two are bad, because then on your first query, you have a 2/3 chance of picking a bad server. And then on the next query, you have a 50-50 chance because you've eliminated the one bad server. So this is simple combinatorics. I'm sure you all remember from your freshman year at university. Anyway, now, impact of bad servers. These are when we actually did get an IP address, and it doesn't answer properly. In my feeling is that most likely, in most cases, this is going to be because the server's not working properly, and this is probably more likely to cause badness for the user. I don't know that that's true. This is just a guess. The further analysis would be required to confirm this suspicion, but my suspicion is that an IP address that's not answering properly is probably a higher cost than an NS that's not working right. And that's delay for the user, which is, again, and as far as lameness goes, delay is probably the worst thing. And then for bad servers, the exact same logic applies about your chance of hitting a bad server. So if you have a set of 5 IP addresses, then if one of them is bad, you have a 1 in 5 chance of hitting that at random on your resolver. So, I did this analysis for the reverse tree. I think a similar analysis could be done by anyone running a delegation-only name server. If you care about lameness of the people that you're delegating for, the technique is pretty straightforward. If you want to try something like this, you can please talk to me. I can either give you the code, or I can possibly run the analysis on your behalf if you're an OARC member right now. Anyway, that's just it. So please talk to me if you're interested in this kind of thing. Right. Getting back to the numbers. Right. So I didn't put commas in. So it looks like about 16.5 million packets were scanned in this thing. And of course, as you would expect, about half of them were the replies that we sent. The other half were the queries. There were a few unparsable replies. DNS has all kinds of crap in it. And the packets with non-zero R code, these are mostly NX domains, but there are also errors and things like that. But the important thing to notice about non-zero R code is that it means lameness doesn't matter if it has a non-zero R code, because you're not getting a server, you're not getting a reply that affects the user. There were a bunch of packets with stale NS. These were the ones that I mentioned earlier, where because we're running the capture at a different time than the lameness check, I was able to detect that and kind of discount these. Right, and then Yeah, so we have a number of packets with NS in the RR set. So my estimate, well, you can see the numbers there. And the reason these are not integer numbers is because of the probabilistic nature of the replies that I described earlier. So if one of your two name servers was lame, I consider that about a 0.5 queries that's actually being affected. So these are estimates, and all further numbers that I'm giving are estimates of what the impact on the user will be. And what does that actually mean? This is our chart, and the nice blue area there is my estimate of how many responses came back and the user got a successful reverse lookup on the first try. The I'm not sure what color that is. We'll call it wine. The wine-colored area there is answers that are probably NX domains, but they could be errors also. Anything that's not just a valid response that says, here's an answer that you can use. Now, these thin little lines there are everything else. So the green one is... that's where you got an A or a quad A record, but you couldn't connect to the server and get an answer for whatever reason. And that little tiny yellow sliver is the NS lookup failures. And then even smaller is the stale NS and then some parse errors. So the key message from this is that all of those errors are a tiny, tiny little sliver and don't really have a huge impact. So about 0.3% of queries that users actually sent to the name server would have gotten a bad NS, would have been impacted by a bad NS. And as out, 0.8% had an error because of these bad, the server's not actually working. So my estimate, based on all this, is that about 1% of queries were affected by lameness. Okay. So this is I say estimate because of course it's an estimate. The results do not account for caching. Caching could make things better or worse. We don't actually know what users are doing. My intuition tells me that the picture from the user side is actually much better than the 1% because the resolvers are gonna discover the errors and cache the good results. But I don't know that. That's just a guess. I also have to admit that when I was about done with my results, I noticed that I was strictly looking at IP and not doing the full mapping of IP plus domain. So it may be those results may be slightly better or slightly worse if you have some servers that are answering properly for some domains and not others. So yeah, if I run this again, I'll fix that. I don't expect that the results will be significantly different though. As I discussed a little bit, the effects of the bad name servers. Yeah, we don't really know what because of the data doesn't capture the full richness of possible problems. We don't really know what's going on with the bad name servers. I don't actually know what the effects on the user is going to be, which is kind of the reason I left them as a separate field rather than kind of collapsing all this. And the effects of bad name servers is also slightly uncertain. We don't really know what's going to happen from the user point of view. So what does this mean? Well, as Anand said, about 5% of servers are lame. So why did I come up with this 1% number? And I think if you think about what's going on in the DNS, it's pretty straightforward. If I have a server and it's not being used, then it doesn't matter whether it's lame or not. It doesn't get fixed. I don't have time, and that's the reason it's broken. But if people are using their server, then people don't notice right away, but eventually they notice, and they do fix it. And so the question is 1% too much? I don't know. I tend to think it's a rounding error. The internet is full of bad things. I did a brief check of DNSmon data for a 1-day period, and I found that the background error rate in DNS, as recorded by DNSmon, is about 0.3%. To the NSPRI, to this server. Now, the average DNSmon rate was about 0.8%, which implies to me that in the DNS world, a 1% error is something we can live with. Well, it cost-benefit analysis, but so I have three proposals. The first is that we stop doing blanket emails. I think it's just spam, to be honest. Two possible ways to move forward are one is that we can produce a more targeted report. Most of this stuff goes through LIRs, and we can actually perhaps ask the RIPE NCC to produce an annual report that they give each of their members when they send their bill and say, here's a review of your DNS. By the way, you're lame here. If you want to ask us how to fix it, we'll help. Because there's already a form of communication there that we can rely on. And the final proposal is it might be possible, I haven't done the analysis, it may be that you have a certain number of servers which are causing most of the problem. So rather than send a blank email, you look at the queries that you're getting, find the ones that are causing the most problem, and then don't send a blank email, but send a specific email to just those users. I think a little bit of further analysis is required if we want to move forward with that, and it is going to cost time on the NCC. So I think that's it. Yeah, that's all I have.
Thanks, Shane. Any questions, comments?
Ed Lewis, actually, I have a lot of comments about lameness. I'll probably talk to you afterwards about some of the history, because I'm clued into a lot of the history of where this came from.
Right, that's cool.
But I think on the other hand, your questioning of why to do this actually is a valid question, given what I know, too. Although I would disagree with how you got to that, but I think you got the right place. The question is, this is a database cleanup operation now. I think that's the way to look at this. Is this worthwhile doing because you want to clean up what's in the database as opposed to trying to save the queries on the internet? I'll leave that just as a general. What you're trying to do is you're trying to make sure that what's registered is correct, the name servers are correct, and so on. And there's a value to that, which may be totally distinct from saving packets on the internet.
Why do I care? Why do I care if someone has bad data if it's never accessed?
You may not care. I do.
And who are you?
This is Daniel again. I think this community wants to project the image of having its house in order. And definitely we at the RIPE NCC, we regularly get criticized by our antagonists for the crappy databases that we keep, which is totally unjustified, actually, if you compare it to other sorts of databases. So there is, I agree fully with what Ed has said, there is an intrinsic value in cleaning up the databases which we publish.
If the RIPE NCC was going
to... There may not be an operational... Excuse me, sorry. I made a pause to think.
Okay.
This is day four of the RIPE meeting. Bear with me. There may not be an operational value, but there certainly is a publicity and political value. Now I'm finished.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. If the RIPE NCC was bearing the cost of the cleanup, then I would agree with you completely. However, the RIPE NCC is not bearing the cost. It's the DNS administrators who have to spend the time and resources to figure out what's going on and fix it.
Okay, this assumes, excuse me, this assumes that there is a difference in interest and in between those DNS administrators and the RIPE NCC. I think the RIPE NCC has no intrinsic interest in cleaning this up. I said very carefully, this community has an interest in cleaning up its databases, and I think those DNS administrators are quite, since this is reverse DNS, are quite clearly part of this community.
I guess we just disagree then.
Hmm. Olaf, are you in line? Okay.
Olaf agrees with Daniel. Uh-oh.
No. I wanted to be a little bit more value neutral than agree with or be opposed to. But there is a point about, as an industry, making sure we have our act together if it comes to issues of consistent management of everything we do. And that is what I heard Daniel say. Now, as a community, you might agree might agree or disagree that RIPE NCC has a role in it. This is where I haven't made my mind up myself, but I think that point that we as an industry have a joint responsibility to basically keep our act together in multiple aspects of running the internet. You know, it's an important message, and that's what I agree with.
I guess I know I'm over time, and I apologize, but I guess I'd just like to end and say that I understand the desire to want to keep your house in order. I think what we failed to do was think about the cost benefit, and I consider the benefit very low. If we look at the, if assuming my estimates are right, and I think that because of the effects of caching, we're looking at significantly less than 1% of end user queries are actually affected. And I think if we compare that to the background error rate of DNS, it's about the same. I think there are better ways to spend our time and effort than looking at lameness. That's all.
Okay, thanks, Shane. I get you got that message through. Nonetheless, we saw that in Anand's presentation. I guess much of the criticism / suggestions that you made last time had been taken up, so the error was corrected. The selection of targets for the email was tightly focused, not to involve too many parties that couldn't respond, and the frequency has significantly been reduced. You had the three proposals on there. I think the annual report to the LIRs might be an interesting thing. Actually, I'm inclined to try to throw that over to the fence to the NCC Services Working Group. But I guess we need some more discussion on this. The blanket emails versus the suggestion by Anand, we need to combine these a bit here. My proposal would be to, first of all, that the RIPE NCC be given a chance to get some experience with their newly implemented schedule, but at the same time, and that's happening today, I guess, be very careful in seeing these signs of harassment or embarrassment that you mentioned, like people get these emails and they have to actively ignore them. Is that a path forward? What does a working group think? I'm just not happy to do voting in either way here because we just don't have enough combinatorics here.
I'm quite happy to do this on the mailing list as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for that matter, can we then actually close the action item that was on the NCC and you for doing the analysis and coming back and fixing errors? Are there any objection to that? No. Okay, anybody still awake, by the way? Oh, quite a lot. Thank you. So we closed that action item so far for the minutes. Emil, did you catch that? Thank you. And I think we take that to the list and start ahead from there with some experience gathered and feedback from affected operators.
Okay.
Thanks, Shane. And next on the agenda is Dwayne Wessels from OARC, who will present us findings. I love this new vocabulary. From the root zone impact analysis that was carried out by OARC under contract with ICANN, together with Jeff Sisson, who isn't here today. It's yours.
Thank you. Yeah, so I definitely want to reiterate that Jeff Sisson did the bulk of this work. I'm just lucky enough to be able to be here to present it to you today. And by the way, I expect to be skipping some of these slides. So as has been said, there are interesting times ahead for the DNS route. Lots of new and exciting things coming up with additional IPv6 glue, DNSSEC, IDNs, and more TLDs, as well as continued growth and continued Anycast expansion. So earlier this year, ICANN contracted with OARC to do a study that simulates changes to the root zone, looking at five particular areas. First, just simply the size of the zone file itself, or the zone data. Two, how a larger zone affects server response latency, how it may affect server start and restart times, bandwidth requirements for zone transfers, and how these changes might affect truncation and increased TCP. So in the interest of time, I'll probably talk about 1, 4, and 5, and I may sort of skip over 2 and 3. Um, Just a note about the hardware that we used. ORC has this sort of nice test bed with 16 big servers. Each server has 4 cores, and each server has 16 gigabytes of memory, although for one of the servers, we did upgrade it to 32 so that we could test some of the larger zones, and we have some gigabit switches. The software that we tested is Bind 9.6, as well as NSD 3.2.1. The operating system was usually Linux CentOS. We did a couple things on FreeBSD. The tools that we used are DNSperf, TCP replay, NistNet, and then some custom scripts. We tested quite a variety of zone configurations. There were 5 different types of zone content. First is an unsigned zone, sort of the current state of the zone with mostly IPv4 glue. The second is also unsigned, but with as much IPv6 glue as there is IPv4 glue. So in other words, every NS record has both types of addresses. Then we have, building on that, we have a signed zone with both types of glue, and where 10% of the delegations have DS records, 50% have DS records, and 100% have DS records. And for each of those 5 types of content, we tested 5, we had 5 different sizes of zones, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1 million, and 10 million. Now, we didn't exhaustively test all of these combinations, but we did get pretty good coverage. So the first task was to look at memory usage, and the way we approached this was to look at how big does the name server process get in memory when you load these zones. And on Linux, we use this utility called PMAP, which reports the process size as well as memory used by shared libraries and other sorts of things. Here's a graph that shows the memory usage for Bind for all of the types of zones and all of the sizes of zones. And note that both axes here are logarithmic, so a little bit of the detail is lost. But you can see, as you would expect, you know, more or less proportional. The memory usage is proportional to the zone size. Here's the same for NSD. And I don't know if I can do this or not, but if you cycle back and forth, you see that they're more or less the same. One thing you might note here is that we don't have any data for the signed 10 million TLD cases because we didn't have enough memory to load it on our largest server. So it would take more than 32 gigabytes of memory to load a 10 million TLD signed zone with NSD. So the conclusions here are that the memory usage or the zone data is proportional to the number of TLDs. If you have a fully signed, fully glued zone, you use about twice as much memory as an unsigned zone of today. And as I mentioned, this little wrinkle with NSD. Next thing we looked at was response latency. So to tackle this, we synthesized some PCAP files with queries whose characteristics were derived from some diddle data taken earlier this year. Then we replayed those queries with TCP replay. And in all cases, the queries are replayed at a constant rate of 5,000 per second. And this graph shows the behavior of Bind with an unsigned zone of 5 different sizes. Note that here the x-axis is linear, and if you can read that, it's in milliseconds. So this is latency sort of seen right next to the server, the time taken between a packet, you know, going into the box and then coming back out. Also note that it's you know, quite uniform between all the different zone sizes. There's not much change there as the zone gets bigger. And here's the same for NSD, an unsigned zone or unsigned zones of increasing sizes. And there's a little bit of variation there as the zones get larger. You know, the histogram here kind of shifts down and to the right a little bit. But Again, note this: the x-axis here is linear, and the scale is a little bit different than for bind. So, slightly better there. This graph shows bind's behavior for a signed zone, and here you can see that there's actually some significant change when we get up to like 100K zone, 100K TLD zone. The performance starts to drop off, and it's a little bit hard to see on this graph, so I also included a cumulative distribution function. The blue line in the middle is sort of the interesting case here. So if you look, also note that here the x-axis is now logarithmic, still in milliseconds, but when you get to way out here at say 1,000 milliseconds or 1 second, in this case, something like 30% of the queries were not being returned or timing out. And here's the NSD behavior for the signed zones. Not quite the same problems. A little bit of degradation in performance, but not quite to the same extent. And here's the cumulative distribution for NSD. Also, note here there is at the end there. There's a 4.5 million TLD zone. As I said before, we couldn't get a 10 million TLD zone loaded, but we were able to test this with a 4.5 million TLD zone just to have something to put there. So for this task, bind's performance is stable for all sizes of unsigned zones, as is NSD's. Bind's performance degrades a little bit with the larger signed zones, and this is a problem that ISC has already identified and working on a solution. I don't know if Shane can speak to that or not, but maybe later. You can tell us the status of that if you like. And just to sort of, nice typo there. Just to sort of address this a little bit more, I want to emphasize that this performance issue is only a problem with NSEC zones. There is no issue with NSEC 3. This is only an issue with a zone like the root where it's likely to have a large number of glue owner names in between non-glue names. And it only becomes a problem when the zone gets something of the size of 100,000 TLDs. So this is not anything that we need to worry about today. You don't have to panic and start upgrading or anything like that. I think there's plenty of time until this fix will really be necessary. And here's a cut and paste of one of our zone files that we used in the test just to show, just to highlight the problem. This, I don't know if I have a pointer here. But so here are the COM delegations. These are the authoritative data. And then because we ended up using NS records that end with .com, something like 10,000 of them get inserted between there and the next TLD that we inserted there. Okay. I'm going to skip over this a little bit and kind of skip to the conclusions of task 3. And there's not a lot of surprises here. The start and reload times are proportional to the zone size. One thing that we found was although bind could load the 10 million TLD zone within 32 gigabytes, it could not reload it within that much. I'm also going to skip over this a little bit because they tend to be a little bit boring. Everything's proportional to the zone size. One interesting thing we did discover is that when NSD uses the master, it uses name compression, and so that results in some bandwidth savings. And we have some data there about what happens to zone transfer times in the event of packet loss and so on. 5 minutes, thanks. So last I'll finish with talking about TCP stuff. We took some actual client traces from the DITL data and replayed those against servers configured with different types of zones. The first graph I want to show you is with so that here the I think the client trace actually came from LRoot. This is serving a signed zone. There's a note there about abnormal queries being removed, and that's because in the data that we collected, there was a small number of clients that had some sort of aggressive behavior that were skewing the results, so those were eliminated. So the point of this is that if you took, this is with sort of a today's zone, if you took today's zone and signed it, you would expect to see something like 0.3% of queries being truncated and you know, probably being retried via TCP. Most of these turned out to be NX domain responses. A small number were queries for the root zone with a query type of any. Yeah, go ahead.
Short, Daniel, short question. Definition of truncated, T-bit set or glue omit, or additional information omitted?
TC-bit set.
TC-bit set. Okay, thank you.
So that was with a current size zone, and this graph shows with both a current size zone and with a 1 million TLD zone with lots of glue and lots of DS records. And in this case, the amount of truncation jumps from, say, 0.3, 0.4 to 0.7, 0.8, something like that. And this plot shows a histogram and cumulative distribution of the sizes of responses that would have been truncated. So to get this, we took the client trace and picked out all of the queries where the DO bit was set and the EDNS size was set to 512. And then we changed the EDNS size to the maximum so that they wouldn't actually get truncated. And we measured the responses of those packets. There's a spike somewhere around 650, and now off the top of my head, I forget exactly what that spike is from. It's in the report. And then there's another spike closer to 700. Okay. So based on this, we sort of concluded that a root server could expect something like an order of magnitude increase in TCP when the root becomes signed. For a root, we measured or predicted them going from, say, 5 queries per second to more like 50 per second. We noticed that a larger zone caused also an increase in truncation or TCP traffic, and we think that's due to generally longer names in the NSEC records because we assume that when you get to something that scale with a million TLDs, you're going to have sort of longer TLD names. And then based on the last graph, UDP responses that might be truncated would be no smaller than, say, 825 bytes if they weren't being truncated. So that's what I have to present today. There's a URL here if you'd like to read the full report or email addresses for us to get in contact with us.
Okay, thanks, Dwayne, very much. For the moment, clarifying question only, please, because we have the other presentation and afterwards 20 minutes of discussion.
Not a question.
Okay, no questions? Then again, thank you very much, Dwayne.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd like to ask Lyman Chapin to come on the stage to give a presentation about the root zone study findings. Another effort contracted by ICANN.
Now, I know we're running a little short of time. I want to be sure we have plenty of opportunity for discussion. So in part because I presented a lot of this material on Tuesday during a plenary session, I'll be as brief with this as I can. A quick recap, what I'm going to focus on here today is some of the implications of the findings that I talked about on Tuesday. The Scaling the Root report is available, has been since September 7th. And it's a product of a study that was undertaken by the six people that you see on this list Most of those six people are still here. On Tuesday, I said that they're all here. Most of them are still here. Just a quick recap. What we're talking about when we talk about scaling, of course, is a combination of four factors. And of the four factors that are on here, for the discussion that I think we're going to have today, it's worth pointing out that there, two of these are, in some sense, happening already. We heard Matt Larson and Joe Abley, tell us on Tuesday that the root zone will be signed, full stop. And we also can probably conclude from the circumstances surrounding the exhaustion of the free pool of IPv4 addresses that it's unlikely that we're going to see a scenario in which, for example, we start refusing requests from TLD registry operators to add quad A's for their name servers. That just seems highly unlikely. So of the four things that we're dealing with, it looks as though DNSSEC and the new address records in Glue for V6 are pretty much foregone conclusions, and we might want to keep that in mind as we talk about what options we might have for dealing with some of the consequences of the study that we undertook. I won't go into detail on the model. I described this on Tuesday. We can come back and refer to this if necessary when we have some discussion. But essentially, we have a model that incorporates all four of the domains in which the root system plays out and the six principal actors. Run through the findings again, the most important of which, of course, is that it is extraordinarily difficult to perform a quantitative modeling simulation of the root for the simple reason that the root is both dynamic and decentralized. So the way in which the individual pieces respond to changes from a combinatorial standpoint quickly becomes intractable from a quantitative modeling standpoint. We can do some quantitative models and some very useful studies, and Duane's just described one of them. It's not that quantitative modeling and numbers are not useful. It's that they're not terribly useful in helping us to make long-term decisions about how we ought to be looking at the evolution of the root system as a whole. So it may be very useful as a tool to help us understand some of the, in particular, the near-term effects of taking certain actions. But it turns out to be, unfortunately, remarkably unhelpful in drawing conclusions that apply in any meaningful sense to the root system after it has evolved past what amounts to a very short term. And therefore, we're proposing that the goal of oversight of the root system, the responsible goal of oversight, should be instead to develop this concept that we're calling an early warning system, which involves both deciding what markers of stress are both genuinely meaningful in the sense that they give us some actual useful intelligence about what's happening and are measurable. And many of the metrics are probably available today, but we haven't gone through the exercise of determining for each of the actors in the root system what are the things that would be useful to keep track of and how would we go about measuring those and coordinating the measurements so that we would have a complete picture of all the different parts of the system. There's a second question that goes along with that, of course, which is having arranged to take those measurements and having arranged to collect them and have somebody look at them, what sorts of actions might the community be prepared to take if, for instance, one of the metrics were to create cause an alarm condition or otherwise exceed a threshold that we decided was significant? Those are two separate questions. I suspect that the second of those two is going to be harder to answer than the first. We came up with data to support two conclusions that I don't think will surprise anyone. The first is that on the provisioning side, which is the process whereby new information, changes, and new delegations and so forth that arrive as requests at IANA find their way through the root zone management system into the definitive root zone database that's maintained by VeriSign as the root zone editor. And that process is completely dominated by the human intervention steps, by the requirement that exists and which will continue to exist for the foreseeable future as a matter of policy, for there to be a human inspection of every change that takes place. And that human inspection takes place at the moment and, again, will continue to take place and for the foreseeable future absent a change in policy in IANA, NTIA, and VeriSign. So in all three places, there's a human inspection of every change that goes into the root. On the publication side, not surprisingly, the effect of increasing the size and or volatility of the root is felt primarily at the end of what we call long, thin pipes. So locations that are either poorly connected in the sense of either low bandwidth or very high error rates, or are poorly provisioned in the sense that it's difficult to put, you know, state-of-the-art servers and other kinds of equipment at those sites. And the net of all of the study, all of the investigations that we did, is that it's relatively easy to demonstrate that all of the actors in the root zone system would be capable of absorbing an increase, and by increase I mean both increase in size and increase in volatility, on the order of hundreds, and that's a deliberately vague term. We're not talking order 100 in the sort of algorithmic complexity sense, 100 times. We're talking about an increase of, you know, hundreds of new entries and or hundreds of new change requests on an annual basis. That level of scale, of scaling, could be absorbed by the system without any of the actors having to go into what we call a replanning phase, where they would have to, you know, decide to do things differently, either from a personnel standpoint or from an equipment and infrastructure standpoint. But when you get to order 1,000, in other words, thousands of new entries or thousands of new change requests, the message is not that you can't do that. In other words, that something will break if you do that. It's that one or more of the actors in the system would have to do something differently. And, of course, that's something that, you know, one or more actors could decide to do, given sufficient will and resource and funds and so forth. But it means that the normal course of events, the normal way in which organizations typically do refresh of equipment or new hires or so forth, would not sustain that level of growth. So one or more of those organizations would have to do something differently. And this is the slide that I put up on Tuesday to describe this concept of a replanning region. We worked with a model of dynamic operating regions that essentially identifies a range of scaling within which an organization can deal with what we call sort of run-of-the-mill or normal everyday increases. And then there's a discontinuity at which point an organization would have to replan to accommodate either larger load. And that replanning might involve, you know, deciding to double the size of the organization by hiring lots of new people, or to, you know, buy and install and provision a different, different class of hardware. But they're the kinds of decisions that an organization can't make without going through some sort of fairly substantial process of replanning that might involve, you know, some higher level manager signing off on things and so forth. There's a third region that we hope we never get into, which is one in which the basic architecture of the system as it's currently constructed would not be capable of handling the load, even if each of the actors were willing to spend lots of money and do lots of upgrades. And that's a situation in which, for example, it might become impossible to operate the provisioning system with the level of checks and balances that currently exist. And then you'd be in a, you know, completely uncharted area where you'd be trying to determine how to deal with the desire to have a near zero error rate in the provisioning process through some other means. The means that is in place right now works very well. Just a couple of the effects of root zone changes, because we looked at, again, the effect not just of adding new TLDs to the root, but also adding DNSSEC and IDNs and V6 glue. And I won't go into these in detail. These charts are also in the report. But the interesting thing about this and this second chart right here, which shows what the impacts are, is that the combination of effects is more significant than any of the effects individually. But they are not as sort of negatively synergistic, if you will, as we thought they might be. For the most part, the effects that are felt by adding new record types, for instance, to support DNSSEC, are precisely what you would expect, and they're not really exacerbated or otherwise enhanced by any of the other factors. So it is possible to talk about each of them roughly in isolation. There are some combined effects, but they tend to be relatively small. And again, we can talk about those in detail during the discussion. I'm going to continue to go through this pretty quickly. I'll close with the dedication page that was in the report in the version just prior to the one that we released, just so that, sort of as an antidote to, taking ourselves too seriously here, because we talk about these things. They're all pretty, some of the things we've been talking about in the course of the study sound pretty grim, And I think we need to keep a little bit of perspective. We're all doing a pretty good job, and I think we're going to continue to do a pretty good job, and we're going to be able to fix this. And I'll stop there, and you can take us into discussion.
Okay. Thank you, Lyman, for that presentation and the additional
specific questions. Or?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to have specific clarifying questions to this presentation.
And I'll sit down.
And absent these, I'd like to open the floor for general question and discussion on this topic. And I'm trying to be a bit organized regarding queue management. The layout of the room is a bit bad, but I'd like to ask people to line up at the microphone and then indicate by raising their hand that they're introducing a new topic or a new issue so we can keep the discussion focused and, keeping it soon. But first of all, clarifying questions to this presentation. None? Okay, so then... Thank you, Lyman, again. But you're not relieved. So then the floor is open. Please line up at the mics. I guess the first speaker doesn't have to raise their hand because... Jim.
Okay, raising my hand because this is a new issue. Jim Reed, just a random member of the public... I think the route scaling study work that Lyman's group has done is a great piece of work. I'm a bit concerned how some of the information that might be used out of context. However, let's put that concern to one side. The key points that I took out of the survey was that the scaling group is saying is that ICANN has essentially got a choice to make. Over the next couple of years, we can have a signed route, we can maybe have IDN CCTLDs, we can maybe have more IPv6 at the route. Or we can have new GTLDs, but we can't have all four of those things. So I think what's needed to do is to tackle those things in a priority order. And I think it's also... Okay, that's better. I think these things need to be prioritized, and obviously there's going to be competing demands on people's priorities. But one of the most important things that needs to be clarified, in my opinion, is that these tasks are done one at a time. It's bad operational practice to try and change two or more variables at the same time. The combinatorial effects are quite tricky. There could be unforeseen second-order effects. So I think the basic engineering principles we have to underline here is make one change, measure its effects, satisfy ourselves that everything has reconverged back to a stable state for some definition of stable, and then proceed to the next one and iterate through these things until all these things that are on the, if you like, the route change plate are then dealt with. That's my personal opinion, and I wonder what other folk feel about that.
Any responses to that? Okay, so then Daniel. Oh, wait. You're responding? So then John, please.
John Schnitzlein, I'll respond to Jim's point. In a previous discussion of the route scaling study, it was pointed out to me that 20% of the TLDs in the route already have Quad A records, that Quad A records are added to the route on demand, and that's the way it should be, and no one has advocated stopping adding Quad A records to the route. I think a strict interpretation of do only one thing at a time doesn't fit with the ongoing process of adding Quad A records.
Olaf Glukman, NL at Labs. Strictly one thing is very difficult to define in an evolutionary environment such as which I think the route is. Things are added fairly slowly now. New TLDs are added. New CCTLDs are added because new countries start to exist. IPv6 glue is added. DNSSEC, that is a real change. That is a measurable step function. There are other things which will increase the pressure on the system, which increase the flux of changes, the scale of changes. Those might interact with each other, and I'm not quite sure how you would say, first do these and then wait until you figure out what the impact is.
So the wording you phrased seemed to me to be a little bit imprecise.
Yes, you're right, Olaf. It may be a little bit imprecise. Perhaps that's because I've maybe not completely thought everything through to the extent that perhaps I should have done. I do think, though, however, that, yes, you're right in a sense to say that adding more IPv6 could be considered more of a continuous process, and adding a new gTLD from time to time could also be just a continuous process. But I think we're going to see a significant step change there. Rather than just say, for example, one new TLD every 6 months or a year or so, or an additional quad A glue record going in there, we could see large numbers of these things being embedded in a very short space of time. And that, I think, then becomes, it's more of a step change type thing rather than a small amount of continuous enhancement type activity. And that's what I'm really getting at here. And the thing I think particularly about IPv6 is we're going to have a fairly panic fairly soon because the world's running out of IPv4 addresses, and we may have to be in a situation where lots of IPv6 gets added to the route in very short order so that everyone's ready for the IPv4 crunch.
Rob Blocksdale. I think of the four changes presented and studied in this report, there are two different classes. Signing the route, we know exactly how big that is, the increase in the route zone. It is not unpredictable. Putting IPv6 glue in the root zone. In principle, we know exactly how much extra information that carries. Having 30 or 40 IDNs added, that is about the level of requests from the community. Again, it's quite easy to estimate how much change that in the size of the root zone and how much burden on all the processes will involve. Of course, adding new gTLDs, that is an enormous question mark because nobody really can say, are we talking about 10, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 100,000,000? And there is this interesting thing which is a non-tactical issue, but in the ICANN environment, the U.S. Legal environment, once you open that window, it is very difficult, I think, to close it. So that is, for me personally, the most interesting aspect of this whole thing to see evolving. And I think it's also the most dangerous one of the four. The other three, I'm convinced we can do in a controlled fashion. Not all three on the same day, but in a well-controlled, defined manner. But the real question mark and the real challenge, to be friendly, is how to handle a flood of 10 million gTLD requests. It might be, and the report already mentioned this, that we might be saved by the fact that we have silly procedures which have a lot of human intervention per request. That will maybe trickle it down.
Okay, thank you. So we're still on the topic of the relative impact of the four suggested additions. Alex, on that topic?
I mean, what I got away from the two presentations is that Duane said, sorry, my name is Alexander Mayhofer from the Austrian Registry. What Duane said, that essentially there are not any technical limits in, let's say, scaling up the route to the equivalent of a 10K TLD. That's what I got away from it. I agree with Olaf that the step between an unsigned and a signed route is probably the scariest one because it's going to introduce a whole bunch of TCP queries. That's, I think, the greatest impact. And it's going to increase the size, of course. And I don't expect for the new GTLDs, because of the very complex effort process, because of the huge effort of about 1 million euros involved in getting such a new TLD, if you include all the lobbying and all the preparation of the documents that you have to do, then so I don't expect that there will be millions of new TLDs in the first round. So if I would have asked how many domains would be the maximum to expect, I would say it's a couple of hundreds at maximum.
Okay. I have a clarifying question now to maybe Lyman and his team, because you're touching upon an interesting issue.
One short point, Peter. I fully agree that the administrative problems, how the root zone is managed, are a big issue, because and even is ICANN and Diana going to review every signature once you have a newly signed record? So
different topic, probably. The clarifying question.
The answer is no.
The clarifying question I have is, was or was not the assessment of probabilities of the shape of the curve part of the study? Shape of the curve meaning what you said. Where will it end? How many GTLDs will be there? And I think to that extent that should be clarified whether it was or not.
Yeah, we very specifically, and this was because we were told to do it this way, very specifically did not rely on any contractual or administrative sources of friction in the system. So, for instance, people have observed that it takes ICANN historically between 6 and 12 months to conclude the contract negotiations with a new registry operator. Okay, now, if you imagine that introducing new TLDs could not happen any faster than would be allowed by a process that completed contract negotiations in, let's take the optimistic side and say 6 months, you would have a very different scenario than if you were looking at a system that, as Duane and others have shown, from a technical standpoint, can sustain a much larger number of TLDs. So on the one hand, you realize that the technical parts of the system, the software and the hardware and most of the people processes, particularly on the distribution side, the query side, can handle very large zones. Obviously, we have very large zones that are being served for some of the TLDs already. If you have that observation on the one hand, and on the other hand, somebody brings up the point that the administrative process that ICANN uses right now to actually introduce new registries into the mix of registry operators takes 6 months to conclude a contract, you've got a pretty big disconnect. And our study deliberately, again, under instructions, deliberately did not consider the administrative friction in the system. We considered only the friction that might be introduced within the root zone management process by the way in which each of the actors conducts its business. So we took into account the fact that IANA has manual checks and it has personal relationships with the administrative and technical contacts at registries. We took all of that into account. We did not take into account the contracting and other sort of surrounding administrative issues that might also introduce delays.
Okay, thanks very much. Patrick, on the same topic or new one? No, not even. Same topic?
Same topic. In reference to Jim's original statement about isolation of variables as you make changes to the zone file, I think the principle is still sound, except that it has to establish a new context or happen in a new context where you have changes that may be happening small and slowly, and you have a sense of how those work already. And if you're going to inject a big change, like signing the root, that has to be done separately, as opposed to doing signing the root and a big ramp-up of something else where you don't know how it's going to behave. So I think Jim's principle is still sound. It just has to be done in a slightly different context because changes are happening all the time.
Thanks. Daniel, you're next.
Okay, I have one to this topic because I think that there's one thing that worries me is what Alexander said. I take away from all this that you can do 10K. That is not what I read in that study. So that's just to make that clear. Also, I'd like to say that I have great admiration for the team that did that study And for the level of insight and the level of presentation that they did in the short time they had, I think they deserve recognition for that. So now for the new topic, I wanted to. if I'm the next one in the
queue. Oh yes, Mr. Prussian, that's so fine.
Yeah. Did you say Saupreis? No, anyway. Okay. Seriously, this has been bothering me for some time. The technical study that we heard suggests that the level of TC bits set and the level of TC queries arriving at the root service with TCP transport is not expected to rise significantly. Now, we always want headroom. And we always want to plan for sort of discontinuities as far as root name servers are concerned. And let's take the hypothetical case that at some root name server, the level of TCP queries that arrive and the amount of state that needs to be kept to deal with them affects the service level on the UDP side. What is the opinion of the room or of the community? What should the root name server operator do? Should they stand by and take their hands off? Or should they go and prefer UDP queries arriving over UDP and EDNS and all that kind of stuff? That was question number one. Question number two, would it be useful for root name server operators to make statements about what they intend to do in those cases before it happens?
A clarifying question, Daniel. If you say service level on the UDP side, do you mean you just have to wait a few milliseconds longer before you get a response, or do you mean UDP? There is a high fraction of UDP packets that do not get an answer.
I think serious degradation of service. So it's either they get dropped on the floor or they get serious delays. I mean, nothing. I mean, if it's not significant, then don't do anything. But I think in my worst case scenario, when I look at how implementations work, and you're close to one of them, then it might actually lead, not even through the name server software, but through what happens in the kernel and all that kind of stuff, might lead to packet drops, yeah, either ingoing or outgoing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing that I'm worried about.
So to inject something that I haven't made up my mind about this, but some of the arguments that I would take into account which I do take into account while making my mind up, is actually, is TCP traffic, the cause of TCP traffic, is that something that is the cause for that TCP product, I have to start again, is the cause for the TCP traffic a problem that is caused by a difficult word, non-compliant things at the edge or in between?
Very likely.
How bad do you want to treat that? A hard, difficult word, because we don't actually measure compliance or not, but how would you treat non-compliance in a general case? It's part of the answer, I guess.
I think you're deviating from Daniel's question a bit. Anybody responding?
Well,
I'll let you judge that. But
this is Shane Kerr. I there's been a continual fear of TCP. The only hard studies that I've done have seen have been kind of pretty ad hoc testing that people have done on individual servers. Having said that, it really looks like modern systems are quite efficient at TCP, and you're looking at maybe you're able to run a third as many queries using TCP as with UDP. Now that sounds pretty bad until we consider that 90%+ of the stuff that you're getting on your root servers is just GORP. So I don't expect that when you get bogus queries, you're going to have a lot of fallback to TCP in that case.
I just wanted to say to respond to Olaf is it's as a root name server operator, I put that hat on very firmly now. I think it's already 10 yards down a slippery slope to make any categorization of queries in due to any criteria just as conformant or non-conformant. I don't think any root operator root name server operator would want to go there. Yeah.
And by the way, you cannot tell from the packets.
Even if we could. Yeah.
Patrick.
I'm happy I can at least reach up to the microphone. Patrick Feldstrom. So I was part of helping writing this report. Thank you very much, Daniel, and others for the ones that like the text, although it might be confusing sometimes. I just want to point out add something to the discussion of what happens with these TCP responses and whatever, that when we were discussing with people the problem with what happens if it is the case that the response size increases, that people, even in the technical DNS community, have a very different view of what actually happens. Is it fragmentation of UDP packets that is the problem? Is it the increase of TCP queries that is the problem? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is the TC bit set in the head, in the packet, or a combination thereof? And this is just, and just because we sort of disagree what actually will happen with different kind of things, it's so problematic to also have the next discussion, which we're trying to have now, which is what are we going to do about it? Okay. And this is one of the main reasons why we thought that the main finding, which is so important, is that we can see pretty clear what's happening with the data we have today, a short period in the future, but it's very hard to extrapolate because there are so many variables.
Can I respond to that? Sure. Because you may note that I quite carefully phrased my question. For the hypothetical case that the TCP loading would seriously affect the UDP loading, I was not going anywhere whether this is likely to happen or not. The thing I am I'm concerned about as a root server operator is the fact that is the hypothetical case, which heaven forbid will happen, that one half of the community will cry at us and say, drop all those TCP queries because UDP is the only real ones, right? Nope. And that may happen. Yeah. And on the other side, if we do that, then lots of people say, hey, you had an implied contract to serve all those TCP queries. And what I'm trying to get is a feeling from the community is like, in that hypothetical case, what do you want us to do? And I don't want the answer now. I just wanted to raise this question.
Absolutely. It was not my intention to disagree with what you said. I was trying to explain why the discussion is so hard. And let me just pick one example of one of the things that we should study in our report. What will the impact be when the size of the primary query gets above 512 bytes? And I claim that we should not have the discussion here, but I claim that we have at least five different responses in this room, and that doesn't make the extrapolation easier.
Okay. Let's declare the priming size out of scope, because otherwise I would have to run to the microphone otherwise. Then please, next please. This is your last chance to go to the microphones because I'll close the queue in 30 seconds. We are running into the break anyway, and we will have one item under any other business.
Yeah.
And then I see Rob opening a new topic and Jim not being sure opening a new topic, yeah. And I guess you were first.
Yeah, I would actually, as an open up other topic, I would like to open up with Jim. But just to go back to one of Daniel's earlier questions, the second one is how should we publish things about that? I'm not a root server operator. I wouldn't even dream to tell a root server operator how they should run their servers. But I do think it would be unwise to give information to tell people how to mount DDoS attacks against the root servers or attacks that are likely to be most successful. Okay. I'll pass the mic over and I'll let other folks speak now.
I think Bill was the next one.
So on Daniel's issue, because the performance tuning
requirements of TCP and UDP are relatively different. What we've been working on is splitting the TCP and UDP traffic from each other at the router level so that we can direct them to different server processes running under different kernels. But we haven't gotten too far with that. We haven't put anything into production yet, so I'm curious whether anybody else is doing the same thing. Okay, well, then we'll try and write it up when we have something further along.
Okay, no one.
Same topic? Or?
Same topic.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, first, DNS goes over TCP and UDP equally.
And you are?
Well, according to. I'm Joao. So you can't just turn one off and benefit of the other. It's just that's not how it works. Second, I've paid close attention to the evolution of statistics of two signed zones. And yes, the day the DNSSEC was turned on these zones, both saw an increase of TCP queries to about 10% of their total query load. Either of these zones gets more queries per second than the root zone overall. None of these zones had a problem. An interesting topic was that since that day, both have shown a decrease on the rate of query. So I don't know why. I'll probably never know why. But the worst day is the first day. And in none of these situations has there been a problem. So I think we are freaking out about something that's very much in the hypothetical field.
Okay. Shane, same topic? Then Rob was first.
No, change of topic.
You have?
Yeah. Okay. I essentially, that what Joao just said is very important. And in fact, I would like to see good data and real measurements about the impact and some analysis on the causes why these jumps in TCP traffic have happened. I to be honest, I haven't seen them.
That stuff needs to be public.
Yes.
Okay.
Change of topic, change of field. We have been discussing some very interesting technical details of DNS provisioning. I now step over to onto another planet, and that's called politics. We have, I think, an excellent report coming out of the technical community, supported by the technical community, at least as represented today here. This report one day will be formally submitted to ICANN, to the ICANN board, and they are there to take decisions. I want to express my personal worry because I'm not completely 100% sure, based on past experience, either as a board member or observing the board for many years, that the right decisions will be taken because there are other pressures than those from the technical community being applied to the ICANN board in this process of reaching a conclusion. So I think we should, as a community, can do two things. In the first place, make it be known that we fully support the findings of this report. And secondly, express our concerns, our good wishes, maybe more diplomatic to ICANN, to come to a right conclusion. Because there are possibilities to take a wrong decision, which cannot be easily repaired afterwards.
Direct response? New topic, anyway.
Well, actually, it's not totally unrelated. We have kind of the four different inputs into our root studies, right? We've got B6, signing the root, IDN, and then turning root into COM. So, well, I
point of order.
Okay, sorry. I think these have kind of, while they're all being thrown in because they're all kind of being considered at the same time, I think they quite obviously have very different motivations. To be honest, I think we can discount V6. It's done. We expect more. but as someone said, we expect it to be limited. We've already got a plan in place for signing the route. We have a timeline. I think that's going to move forward. So I think we can't just ignore it, but I think as far as asking how and why we want to do this, I think it's kind of already been addressed. Now, the other two issues are not really technical issues. They're political, which is kind of related to what Rob was saying. So I guess since I'm a technical guy, I like the first two, and I'm glad they're going forward, and I hate the last two, and I don't know why we're doing them. IDN I can understand because, well, not everyone reads ASCII. So at the ITF in Stockholm, someone asked the question to a bunch of protocol geeks, did anyone in that room support expanding the route to large numbers of new TLDs? And at that time, not a single person was willing to stand up and say that they did, although I did meet a few people afterwards who in private were willing to admit that they liked the idea. So I guess what I'd like to do is ask this slightly different community, does anyone here really like the idea? I shouldn't ask it like that, but I will. Does anyone here really like the idea of a vastly expanded route zone with many
Define
entries?
Define like.
Define route.
Okay.
Okay, come on.
Okay.
Also, the point is not whether I want it or not, but whether I want to allow people who want it to have. I mean, I don't.
Stefan, right. Stefan, stop here.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, that's my question. If someone wants to, you can also tell me later. You don't have to stand up at a microphone. I'm just curious.
We are like almost 50 minutes into the coffee break. It's your coffee break, anyway. Jim, and then. Oh, sorry. Go first.
Just to clarify the process, it is not, strictly speaking, the case that this report of the study team is going to go to the ICANN board for their review. There's a steering group, which is the body that was formed in response to ICANN's request that this study be undertaken. And that steering group is considering both this report and a number of other inputs, and the actual recommendation material that's going to be sent to the board will come from the steering group, not directly from the study team report. Just a clarification.
Okay, thank you. By the way, can I have a show of hands of how many people have actually read the whole report? That's probably 25 to 30 or so, roughly, for the minutes. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jim Reed. My second concern is more of a sort of layer 9 problem with the report, in a sense. The scaling study report clearly points out the need for having some kind of early warning system for alerting people to the fact that the existing processes are beginning to be under strain or breaking down under the load of all the changes that are going on. Now, what's been left unsaid in the report is who is going to have the ability to push that alarm button? I mean, we obviously need some kind of alarm button for it. Who's going to have the ability to push that alarm button, and who's listening to it, and what actions can they then take? So let's take the example to give a little bit more of a hypothetical situation that could occur in real life. Let's say the number of TCP transactions start to create operational problems for the root server operators. Can the root server operators say jointly or collectively, stop, because we're under the load here? And if so, who's going to react to that, and in what way is that going to make a difference?
Root zone's too big.
To answer that one, at least from the status quo, some root name server operators have concluded letter exchanges with ICANN about operational cooperation, and certainly I can speak for Kay, saying that if we were under strain, we would let ICANN know in no uncertain terms, because actually we committed to do that to them.
Okay, I'm a bit in trouble. I'm stealing your coffee break. If you're comfortable staying here, just be silent. Not really silent, I mean. Okay, so I'll just continue here, and if I see the crowd disappear, then we'll cut the queue, which is now cut after Glenn, and then we have the wrap-up and go. And apologies to the online capturer for the extra work. Go ahead.
Giovanni Reno, Nomica.
The early warning system, that's one of the key findings of the report, and almost everyone seems to agree that this is an excellent idea and that something we should really do, et cetera, et cetera. I just want to make it clear that good as the early warning system or an early warning system would be, it is not the case that we've suddenly found the magic way of turning the bad, good question into a binary question. It's not the case that there is an early warning system that will suddenly go from green to red and we know we must do something. An early warning system is still something that's fuzzy. It's still something that will operate on different scales of, well, scales of looking into the future and looking into how things change. So even with an early warning system, we're still operating in a completely dynamic environment with fuzz in all directions.
Regarding that, a point of information, unfortunately, at least for native speakers of English, the term early warning is a little bit problematic because it sounds like you're looking at the radar for the bombers to come over the hill. In fact, in this case, the early warning system doesn't just mean immediate problems. It means problems on the graph of discontinuities that Lyman showed, where they're 3, 18, and 36 months out showing problems. For an early showing problems as we begin to realize they may occur, for an effective early warning system to be in existence, there's got to be a new order of coordination between IANA and their perception of the drivers of change in the root zone and the root zone operators and the people on the provisioning side. And only with that kind of horizon can it really make sense and be effective. Don't think about it in terms of a day or a week or a month. It's too late. Think of it in terms of months to years.
Thanks. Okay, thanks. Daniel?
Yeah. Well, one more thing. What I mentioned before, the agreements between ICANN and at least KRoot say that we keep each other appraised of any developments that may affect the operational things, and what Glenn has just said is exactly that thing. We would expect that ICANN actually tells us in no uncertain terms what their long term plans are. And that is and as we will tell them what our long-term plans are, and we both committed to it. So I can committed to do that, and it's all published. We committed to do that. So as part of that, we would expect, and I say this very clearly and very openly, formally here, we would expect to be informed about the long-term plans so that we can avoid discontinuities.
Okay, thanks. So I'm not going to try to make the mistake wrapping up the whole discussion in a minute. I think we touched upon three very interesting topics here. The one is the relative order and relative impact of the different four suggested additional measures. Service levels and handling of TCP, measurement of TCP, operational queries on the root server side, and then this whole topic of early warning bomber set aside for a second. How far in the future can we predict things to remain stable? This needs more discussion. I encourage everybody to read the report if you don't have not yet done so. Provide feedback and continue that discussion on the mailing list, because I'm sure that the team and also the steering group are still looking for feedback and will take that into consideration. Now, that said, thanks for the very engaged discussion, but you're not relieved. We are still having one remaining issue under any other business, and I'd like to draw your attention to this for another minute. If we get the video back. Great, thanks.
We were trying to get some kind of statement which we could send to ICANN to say thanks and endorse the general idea of getting the route signing. So while this session's been in progress, I've been sort of circulating some text with a few folks to try and get something that I think we could all coalesce around. And I think we've come up with a form of words here which hopefully everybody in this room could agree with. You might not be completely happy with one or two bits of pieces of the wording, but I hope overall this is something that we can generally state is something that we're happy with. We agree that the idea of signing the root zone is a good plan. DNSSEC is mature, it's ready for deployment, and it's going to do good things by increasing the integrity of the global namespace. And we encourage progress towards signing the route. We want to make sure that whenever the route is being signed, there's a wide enough circulation of this information so that everyone's got complete confidence that this is being done in a way which makes sense to the general public, and we've all got confidence this is being done in a way which is not going to destabilize things and will actually ultimately enhance the stability and security of the internet. Now, if we can have broad consensus for that in the working group, I would be happy to take that to the right closing plenary tomorrow if Rob can find some time for me there, and we can maybe then have it endorsed as a statement of the right community. But first of all, is this something, sort of statement, is something this working group could accept? And if so, could I then try and pass it on to get a right statement out of it? Yes.
Yeah, we could actually call for a hum, which is a good idea. So if you don't know this, I'm asking for a hum in favor or opposed to this. If you are in favor, you can, just raise your voice. Depending on your comfort or discomfort, you increase or decrease the volume, and then we'll take the opposite position. So hums in favor of this statement. Opposed. That is silence for the minutes.
Silence usually implies consent.
No. Mr. Reed, you're out.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry for stealing the last few minutes of your coffee break.
Okay, thanks very much. This brings us to the end of the session. I'd like to thank RIPE-NCC staff and audio-video staff for the support. Thanks for capturing the whole session, and thanks for staying. See you in Prague.